Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Well, coming your way in the very, very, very near future, we have got the latest adventure from Sebastian de Castell. Yay! It's called Crucible of Chaos. It's subtitled A Novel of the Court of Shadows. And needless to say, we have to simply turn around and say, Author of the Week, welcome back, Sebastian. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on. I always love coming on the show with you, Alex, and all of your wonderful co-presenters. So it's a real thrill.
Well, we've kind of pushed the boat out a little bit further today, Sebastian, because obviously we normally have North American connections, but we actually have a young lady from Romania, specifically Bucharest, although she's currently in Lincoln, who, again, obviously has a wealth of tales with respect to folklore and such like stuff. And fascinated, of course, to regard that, of course, back in the day, when you're talking about the Greatcoat series, the Spellslinger series, all of that swashbuckling material that's actually there, I'm sure it's only a matter of time before it crosses over into Bucharest. Anna Coscanel, welcome to your first ever Author of the Week feature. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Now, have you got any initial questions you'd like to put to Sebastian about life, the universe, his writing process, or indeed his Spellslinger series? She's frozen in time, Sebastian, quite literally frozen in time. Who would have thought it? But never mind. I'm sure we'll actually work some magic and connect on that side of things in its own time. Unless, of course, you're frozen as well, Sebastian. Are you there?
I am here.
Good. That's all right then.
Anna was not, in fact, frozen. So we were momentarily, I believe, all in three different dimensions.
Wow. You know, this clearly is just the magic of Author of the Week. Anyway, now that Anna's unfrozen and back in our dimension, any questions, Anna, you'd like to put to Sebastian?
Yes. Firstly, I would like to say that it's so nice meeting you. And my first question would be, out of every character that you've ever written, which one is your favorite and which one you feel like resembles you the most?
Oh, that's an interesting one, because those are definitely two different characters.
Yeah.
I think so. So to answer the first one, I think in a lot of ways my favorite character to write is Farius Parfax, who appears in both the Spellslinger series and the Argosy series. And Farius, and also I'd like to point out that I believe the first two books of the Spellslinger series are available in Romanian.
Yes.
So they were translated when they came out some years ago. So Farius is, you know, the Spellslinger series is set in a world where magic is very vital. The most powerful people are mages. But Farius is part of a group called the Argosy, a kind of order of wandering, gambling philosophers who don't use magic at all, but rely on very human talents that all of us can develop, things like, you know, eloquence and resilience and what they call arta ares, which is sort of martial arts, but it's also dance, it's movements, it's all the things that are the inheritance of all human beings, but that they learn to use so well that they can actually, you know, outwit and sometimes outfight wizards. And so I love writing Farius because her perspective on the world is one that's fundamentally, even inside of a fantasy world where everything's about, you know, magic and power and things like that, her perspective is so fundamentally human and humanist, that, you know, that there are wonderful things about us and the things that we all create independent of issues of power and wealth. So I love writing Farius. Your other question is really prescient, though, about, you know, which character does the author, sort of, in this case me, most resemble, because there's a degree to which we're always writing, you know, facets of ourselves, right? Because you have to be able to empathize, you have to, or technically sympathize, you have to be able to feel what that feeling is that makes a character who they are. So in that case, there's a degree to which Kellen, who is the main character in Spellslinger, is very much a part of me when I was 16, when I was sort of looking out at the world and people around me and thinking, you know what, I'm not the strongest person in my school. I'm not the smartest person. I'm certainly not the best looking person. I'm not the most talented. I don't even have the best personality. And that feeling of I am so unspecial, you know, what do I do about it? And of course, I was very fortunate at the time because when I went to my family and I sort of said, you know, I feel really like I'm just not very special. I'm just very ordinary. They were very thoughtful about it. And they looked at me and they said, yeah, you're right. You're not particularly special. You are very ordinary. So what are you going to do about it? Which is what kind of, you know, as a person set me off on trying to go, you know, what is it about ourselves that we can develop? You know, we're not born special. We become special by our interests and what we pursue and our passions and our behaviors. So Callan was sort of me that way. Falchio, who's the swashbuckling hero of the Greatcoat series, is part the parts of my personality that some parts that I like and some parts that I don't like take into sort of more extremes. That's really often what an author is doing when they're writing a character, whether a hero or a villain or someone in between, is we're taking pieces of ourselves that we sort of understand, that we relate to, even when they're ostensibly about other people. You know, even if we're writing about a historical figure, you know, Winston Churchill, we're going, well, I understand, I feel that part of Winston Churchill. And you magnify those things. Which brings us to Estevar Boros, who's one of my favorite characters to write now, who is the hero of Crucible of Chaos, which is set in the Greatcoats world. It's a kind of gothic supernatural mystery with sword fights and a really excellent mule who is his companion. But Estevar is wrestling with a number of things around faith, around how the world is changing around him, how he feels as someone who is, you know, has always prided himself on being vigorous and strong, but he's starting to get older too, as am I, universally, as we all are. And so you take those pieces of yourself. And so every character is part of you. And which character you're most like is an interesting combination. And I'll end it here. It's an interesting intersection between you start writing the character that you feel like you're most like at that moment, but the more you write that character, in a way, almost the more you become them, because you're just thinking that way all the time. And so you finish writing a chapter and then you go out walking to a store, and then all of a sudden you start behaving a little more like that character, which is why I generally don't write serial killers.
Thank you for very much for your answer. It was amazing, and it was amazing because you actually took your time to thoroughly explain everything, and I am so impressed about it. So thank you for answering me.
Thank you.
She's very polite, is Anna, not just a postgraduate student, also a polite interviewer from that point of view. I mean, whilst we might have known you were amazing, Sebastian, I don't normally sort of say you're amazing on a regular basis, but it's good. It's good to know. So it's well sorted.
Well, and I don't think you should hesitate to say how amazing I am as often as you like.
Well, there you go. Clearly your parents didn't. But then again, that was reverse psychology, perhaps. But still, parents are very difficult to bring into the world, as I frequently said. Later on in this particular segment, we'll be talking with R.R. Haywood, who's also a fantasy writer, but believes actually that the key to his success is very much reading novels. And he says that before you can actually really start becoming a best-selling novelist, you need to have read 1,000 novels. I'm just interested from your own point of view, Sebastian, in terms of that's an intriguing sort of line from obviously a British writer. He lives in the Isle of Wight, etc. Clearly operating on the basis by osmosis. He certainly is not a fan of creative writing courses. He maintains you have to immerse yourself and develop from that perspective. Do you think he might have a point?
Well, I try never to disagree with an author who's not on the call, because then you can't have a really good public spat.
This is true.
But I will, you know, I'll let this be a kind of asynchronous form of author warfare. I think that the most fascinating part of being an author to me is that in a way it is process and technique and background agnostic. Everything that you've just described that RR has sort of said, I think is 100% true for a great many authors and 100% false for a great many authors, because it depends on how that individual author responds to what they see out in the world. So I'll give you the simplest example. You could take someone, we could think of an individual, maybe Anna is going to write some best-selling novels at some point, maybe already has, I don't know, but for the sake of this hypothetical, and I'm using you as someone who's going to suddenly decide to write novels. We could give Anna what we or she or the world deems, you know, the 100 best fantasy novels in the current world. And she could read those and study them and really take every single part of them on board. Now, depending on how Anna is as a person, her response to that might be, okay, this is great. I'm taking this. I'm inspired. I'm moving forward. I'm going to write my own thing. It's standing on the shoulders of those books, but it's unique. Or as Anna might be, as so many authors I've met are, especially newer authors, might feel, oh God, you know, it's all been done, and I don't want to sound like I'm stealing from those authors, and I can never write like them. Every time I sit down and write, it doesn't look like Tolkien, it doesn't look like Robin Hobb, it doesn't look like N.K. Jemisin, and that becomes this constant voice in the head. Alternately, we could take, sorry, Anna, I keep using you for this example, and say, look, have you ever read a fantasy novel? She might say, no, I've never read a fantasy novel in my life. In fact, I don't ever read fiction. I've never really been interested in it. And say, Anna, write a novel. I want you to write a fantasy novel. I want you to let your imagination roam. And she might just go and write something that, having nothing else to draw on, is only drawing on her own instincts and imagination, the experiences of life, the dark ones, the light ones. And through that, write something that maybe it doesn't feel like it's like sitting directly alongside those other 100 books, but maybe it's all the more special for it. In the same way, creative writing courses, look, you know, I think it's very, you know, if you go to an author conference and you ask everyone to raise their hand who thinks, you know, MFAs in creative writing are a good idea for professional authors, you won't get a great many hands rising up. And part of that is also because everyone's afraid of what happens if you say they do. However, and I haven't taken an MFA, so you know, but I also haven't read 1,000 fantasy novels probably in my entire life, and nor do I intend to. And you know, and I've been very successful in that field. For a decade, I've made a really great living as a fantasy author. But what I believe about that from the people that I've met that have done it, you learn to read in a way that is very exceptionally well-developed and thoughtful in an MFA program. You learn to be questioning about why you're writing something and what it means. And again, for some people, they might take that and find that it's stifling, that it's not letting them just get to the meat of what they want to do. Let me just sit down and write a good sword fight, you know? But for other people, it might actually inspire them to, when they do write their book, to write something that is much richer and more meaningful because it's questioning a little more. And that's what I tend to see when someone sends me a piece of writing and they've done an MFA program. I often, even if I think the craft of it might need work or it's not commercial enough or something like that, I'll often see a kind of a wonderful questioning, a willingness to stray from the classic tropes. So, look, whoever you are and whatever you've done, you have a novel in you. And the you know, and that is, again, part of the inheritance of humanity. It's the inheritance of literacy. We learn to read, which means we learn to write. And because we exist in this world, in these bodies, in these minds, with these wonderful and tragic pasts, we all have the capacity to write a terrific story, regardless of that particular path that we got there.
I think that's a first-class answer, almost as though you've been on a creative course. But again, it's interesting in terms of the whole element. There isn't a one-size-fits-all. I mean, in essence, what you've just addressed there, Sebastian, is at the heart of this whole notion that for some people, actually learning the structure, the plot structure, the three-act scenario, all of those systems can be quite useful. but not if it's at the expense of, as you've very eloquently put it, the emotion, the feel, the sense, the way you can immerse yourself in it. Is that not at the heart of the challenge at present with ChatGPT, with artificial intelligence, that we're still actually concerned about how that could be impacting the human elements and the human factor in this whole writing scenario?
Well, I've experimented somewhat with ChatGPT at various times, not to have it produce a story, because whenever it does, what I've found, there's two interesting phenomena I've found about ChatGPT and just AI in general. The first is mostly what it's giving you is the most average version of what it's got, because that's fundamentally what it does. It takes, you know, trillions of, if we're talking about fiction, it's taking trillions of pages of often fan fiction and online erotica and whatever else. And then you're saying, okay, write me a wonderful, you know, fantastic fantasy scene. And it is giving you the C+ version of that, because it's not applying a lot of judgments on its own as to what's good or bad. We happen to live in a time where everybody thinks that elites applying a judgment to what's good and bad is terrible, but in point of fact, you do kind of want people with good taste to help us find what are the really good stories and the bad ones. ChatGPT just goes, you know what, here's the most average thing that would sort of fit here. There are ways to play with ChatGPT. I sometimes will play with it for brainstorming. I'll say, you know, let's come up with a whole different kind of tarot cards with different suits and things and just see what it says. Or I want to make a castle with 9 towers. Tell me what each of the towers is. And so you can kind of do those things. But the second thing that's interesting about ChatGPT is because it is constantly learning, because it's constantly being tweaked by its creators and their various engineers, it appears to get dumber over time. And so, which is a really interesting phenomenon. I think there's a group of data scientists who do tests, and they were doing tests on, I think, ChatGPT 3.5 when it first came out, and they would ask it basically a mathematical question, where it would to do with whether something was a prime number or not, like a particularly high number, and you know, which is not a thing ChatGPT is supposed to do. But when they started, when it was first released, it would get it right something like 97.5% of the time. And I think 6 months later, it started only getting it right about 2.5 or maybe 12.5% of the time. So it was literally getting dumber. And my theory is, and this could be completely wrong, and I'm not an expert on AI, but I've also noticed that they keep tweaking ChatGPT to try to make it not say offensive things. If you ask it I did this test once, which is probably a terrible test to admit ever doing. If you ask it, tell me the 5 worst things about, write a 300-word essay about the 5 worst things about this horrible historical figure. It will give you a lovely, eloquent, here you go, this was terrible because this. If you say, tell me the 5 best things about this horrible historical figure, it will basically refuse and say, that's not, you can practically see it humphing. That's, it's very, that was not a good person. And so you go, but wait a minute. I literally would get engaged in a thoroughly pointless conversation with ChatGPT and go, but wouldn't you agree that all human beings are neither fully bad or fully good? We all have good and bad. Yes, of course, absolutely. Good. Tell me the 5 best things about this horrible historical. And I go, no, I want you to not ever prevaricate. And it would just struggle forever. And that's because they are trying, we are all trying, both with ChatGPT, with AI, but also with ourselves, to define what we are allowed and not allowed to say. Because we don't want to create harm, which is a good thing. But the problem is that when we do that, when we start to restrict what we're supposed to sort of say and think, we start to restrict the way that we in fact do think. And in the case of something like AI, I think you can actually make it stupider by not allowing it to think bad thoughts. And as a writer, I will tell you, if someone said as a writer, okay, you're going to write a novel, but you must never think any terrible, unconscionable thoughts while you're doing it, I would never be able to write a novel that was worth reading.
We need both sides, the ultimate paradox. We need to embrace sometimes the dark side, even though we might not want to. It actually helps us become more of a holistic individual, perhaps.
It does, and I think the duty of a writer, I think, is have all these horrible dark thoughts, do all the worst, ugliest research on the planet, you know, that you might want to do. But then your job is to go out and create art without creating harm as best you can. Sometimes you will make mistakes and that's okay, but it's still that duty. It's the same with a comedian. Comedians, you know, people sometimes say, you know, this is inappropriate for a joke, that's inappropriate for a joke. And you say, well, no, wait a minute. It's comedians are supposed to be, the definition is did the audience laugh or is it funny or not? And people sort of say, well, you know, who's to decide, you know, what the sort of boundary line is? And I always say, that's the comedian's job. Their expertise is to take us to the appropriate edge in that moment in time. And when we start to, and I, you know, I promise you, go to a comedy show where the comedian never says anything that might hurt anyone's sense of self, and you will not laugh once. Or you might, because there was one comedian who was absolutely terrific at telling jokes that were funny, but never saying anything cruel. Alas, that was Bill Cosby.
Indeed. Interesting, we had a debate on a recent midweek live drive about words that people found most irritating. And this was where there was an interesting connection. One of our panels actually agreed with me that actually wifey can be seen in a very sort of derogatory way, whereas Anna thought wifey was charming and wouldn't have been in her top 25 most irritating words whatsoever. I'm not sure about totes amazeballs, which actually was number one, but that's a completely different issue. Anna, any other questions or queries you'd like to put to Sebastian?
I have thousands of questions, actually, but I will just stick to two. So, you know how people say that actors, an actor by definition, is a person who needs to make himself audible to an audience without a microphone. What's this one thing for an author that could be compared to the microphone or no microphone for an actor?
A writer has to or seeks to make the audience feel what they're feeling through the particular choices of words. And that is the fundamental, I think, difference between one writer or another. Remember when you hear people say, you know, there's only seven kinds of stories, there's only 30 different stories, there's only X different stories, right? And so if we take, you know, The Lord of the Rings as an example, The Lord of the Rings is a type of story that, you know, we could all set out to write, right? We could write, you know, about these sort of very humble sort of people, a very humble person, a very humble society who suddenly has to take on this quest, and there's all these evil forces and all these powerful groups, and you're traveling through this landscape, and we could all write that story, you know, beat for beat for beat. And what will make it different, what can make it worth reading all three versions of that story that the three of us might write, will be the different ways in which we translate what we feel about that moment into a set of words that someone else will read and hopefully feel what we're feeling. I have a often people talk now, especially writing coaches and books about writing, they talk as if prose was the least important part of a story. You know, what matters in a story is characters or plot or theme, you know, or all of these things. But in fact, there is no such thing in a story. There is no part of a book that is, and here's the characters, right? There's only words. That's all we work with, are words. And the words that we choose and how well those words make you feel what I'm trying to feel as a fellow human being in that moment. Because what would be the point of writing the scene where, let's say, in The Lord of the Rings, which I rewatched recently because it's such a fantastic movie, there's a moment where, you know, Gollum tricks Frodo into thinking that Sam is stealing the food, and that, you know, and Frodo thinks he's got to get rid of Sam, and it's meant to be heartbreaking. What's the point of writing that scene except to elicit in each of us that feeling? We know what that's like, that horrible feeling of being abandoned by someone that we would give everything for. And so it's the words that we choose. So what the writer does, you know, the actor, as you say, so eloquently seeks to be heard by the audience without a microphone. And the writer seeks to be, I think, felt by the audience without being in the room with them, just through the vehicle of the right set of words. That's the alchemical function of fiction.
Impressive. Thank you.
I think that answer was, I think, Alex, you'd agree my answer was totes amazeballs, right?
Words taken out of mouth, literally.
Do we have time for another question?
Yes.
I have all day.
Great. So there are specialists for wine tasting, and they have a full itinerary on how to do it. Do you think that it takes a specialist to be able to conduct an analysis on novel, and for that person to go through some steps in order to be able to say that, yes, that novel is worth reading. Yes, I am a specialist in what I say, and you can trust me.
The classic question about the role of the critic, Sebastian, I sense.
Well, and also the classic question of the very twisting and complex path between subjectivity and objectivity. So if we think of the function of the critic in the modern era, so in past times, we might have pretended that the critic's job was to help form the great canon of works that needed to be remembered. We don't tend to think that way anymore. We tend to think that the function of a critic is to help, in the case of books, readers find books that they will enjoy. And of course, that is the fundamentally subjective element, right? Because the three of us might read a book, and not only might we not all like it, no matter how objectively excellent it might be, but the reasons for which we like it will be maybe entirely different. And I'm sure if you've ever had a discussion with people about your favorite book, you've experienced that sense of, what is wrong with my friends that they don't understand why this book is so fantastic? I love it sometimes when I see, I think I saw a review of one of my books. It was quite old. I think this YouTube spat it up for me in a constant algorithmic quest to ruin my day. It was, I think, somebody saying, like, this book is so, by me, it was like so awful. You all must be reading a different book. And I was like, and I thought, what a beautiful sentence. You all must be reading a different book. Because in fact, they are. Because the function because novels aren't movies. We don't create the same pictures for everyone. We create a text that we seek to be the truest and best story we can. But each of us is a separate director, you know, directing that novel, directing the movie of that story in our heads. And so we will all create a different looking castle and a different looking sword. And in fact, Falchio, the main character in Traitor's Blade, one of the things which I'm most proud of my first, my debut novel, he's never once described. At no point is his hair color, size, face, nothing about him is described. And everybody knows what he looks like because he always looks like whoever that his character evokes in them, which pleases me. In fact, when I was writing Spellslinger, I tried to pull off the same trick and I couldn't. It failed. In the early drafts, people would say, I don't understand. I don't know what he looks like. And so I had to sort of find a way to put that in. So I haven't repeated the trick. In terms of critics, though, you know, you could say, well, if subjectivity is individual and we all have our own opinions, then what's the difference? We don't need critics. The job of the critic isn't so much to tell us what's good and bad, but to help give us a language for understanding why something might seem good or bad to us, why we might enjoy or not enjoy something. In the same way that, so for example, let's take the movie example that I mentioned, Lord of the Rings. There's a lot of reasons to love it. And you can, and as a, when we are an audience, when we're a participant in the moment of the story, it's all one thing. There are no separate pieces. What a critic, I think a good critic learns to do, like a good sommelier, for your example, Anna, is tell us, okay, it might be that what you really like about this is the way these actors perform those roles, the commitment they had, or it might actually be the cinematography. In the case of the Lord of the Rings, for example, a lot of people will watch these days, especially because we have these very high budget fantasy TV series that are getting kind of mixed responses, and people go, well, why is the Rings of Power, which is the big prime TV show that's with a massive budget, you know, and people go, I don't like that. And I loved Lord of the Rings, and it's, but it is kind of part of the Lord of the Rings, so why don't I like it? And it might be that you go, you know, because if you look at Lord of the Rings, every different culture and every different location had a very specific look. You knew exactly where you were because it was so stylized. And so when you have a fantasy world where you have to remember there's all these different cultures and groups and things, the more specific and stylized it is, the more distinct it is. And by the way, it's exactly the same in a novel. When you're reading a novel and you're like, I don't understand, there's all these characters, I can't keep track of them. Often that's because the author hasn't given you the tags, the tools to sort of go, oh yeah, no, I know where this is, or I know who this is. And so a critic, I think, I hope, when they're good at it, or when it's a critic that I, whose critique I enjoy reading, usually about other people's work, I don't enjoy reading critiques of my own work that much. They will tell you, here's these interesting things, and these are objective things, not subjective things. Their subjective evaluation isn't that interesting because it's just them. And so, for example, I used to, when I would teach students story in the past, I would often, and cliches came up, I would often talk about, you know, the scene in really terrible cliche romantic movies where they're on a beach and it's the end of the movie and the two characters are far apart and they're running towards each other in slow motion. We pan to one and is running and pan to the other and she's running and we pan, and it keeps coming up with a crescendo of music until at last they're together and they kiss and you go, oh, that's the most cliched crap ever. Well, it wasn't the first time it was done. It was absolutely heartrendingly beautiful the first time it was done. And so, but if you've never seen that before, you might fall in love with it. And you're, for critic, you might be like, I've seen it a thousand times. So that's not, it's not their job so much to tell us what is good and bad, but to kind of give us an insight into what the objective view of certain types of works might be, which is itself not necessarily, if all you think of is the purpose of critique and the purpose of reading critique is just to identify this is good and this is bad, let's give this an A and this a B and this a C or 4 stars or 5 stars. I don't think that. I think there's a separate pleasure, a separate intellectual curiosity in seeing why someone might say this worked for them and this didn't. And so, you know, in the same way that often we watch politics, even though none of us, few of us are actually involved in giant political events, we don't pay attention to our municipal events, which are the ones that are important that we can affect. And we have to admit that that's because there is a kind of pleasure in that. And there is a kind of pleasure in seeing how we critique books and movies and things. And there is a kind of pleasure, I can't drink wine to save my life. It literally all tastes the same to me. But I can understand that amazing pleasure in going, I like this wine, but why? And having a sommelier say, ah, but see, there's a note of nutmeg and a hint of alabaster and a fragrance of, you know, used sock, you know, or whatever it is they do, which I think is just pleasurable itself.
Yeah, Sebastian, I think a hint of alabaster would be a wonderful title for a possible sequel. Let's return briefly, though, to The Crucible of Chaos, which clearly is coming out very, very soon. A mortally wounded magistrate faces his deadliest trial inside an ancient abbey where the monks are going mad and the gods themselves may be to blame. In a response slightly longer than an X or a former tweet, but slightly less than sort of a sort of fully rounded routine, why is this going to be an outstanding addition to the whole Sebastian de Castell oeuvre?
I think one of the things that was always difficult when I was writing the first Greatcoats Quartet, and for your listeners who haven't encountered the Greatcoats books before, it's a series about these swashbuckling magistrates who go on these judicial circuits, which was a real thing in our own history, but this is in a fantasy world, so there's more sword fights. And they have to hear cases, and sometimes they have to duel in order to enforce the verdict of those cases. And so, you know, there's an element of sort of mystery and courtroom drama and all that stuff implicit in there. But the actual Greatcoats series was set at a time after the Greatcoats had been disbanded because the king had been beheaded. And it's the struggle to sort of bring this country together across these 4 books. And it's the story of Falcio, one man who has been a great coat, who's trying desperately to hold on to those ideals even as the whole rest of the world seems to think that idealism is a complete waste of time. An era not so much unlike our own, I think, at times.
I was going to say the actual title for me actually kind of bespokes Argentina, the Netherlands, arguably what might happen in the United States, and so on and so forth, and what is obviously happening in Ukraine, Gaza, and so on and so forth. Fascinating times, but obviously an outstanding addition, and we're really looking forward to seeing it. Sebastian, amazingly, that time machine hasn't expanded, it's contracted. Clearly, it's kind of coalesced into a way that we're probably sort of appearing in an event horizon somewhere. But have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on your latest Author of the Week feature?
It's been absolutely lovely. I look forward to doing it again soon because I have lots more books coming out. So if you'll still have me, and thank you, especially Anna, for your thoughtful and wonderful questions.
Well, you've already answered the second question, but obviously whether it's Midweek Drive Live or indeed an Author of the Week Zoomer, will you be kind enough to return?
I will be absolutely delighted, and maybe next time I'll actually remember to mention what the book is about.
Wait, we got there. It was important, but we did get there. It was a teaser. And of course, for those people who are well fascinated in terms of that trailer head, in terms of what's coming up with our other fantasy writer from the Isle of Wight, that'll be appearing with RR. In a matter of moments from now. But at the moment, Sebastian de Cassel, how can people stay in touch with you, Sebastian? What's the best way via the socials?
The best way to get in touch with me is at my website, decastell.com. That's DECASTELL. You can also find me on Twitter, which I insist on still calling Twitter because Elon Musk annoys me, and Facebook. But really the best way to, if you like one of the books and want to reach out, decastell.com, and there's a contact page, and I reply to every email I ever get.
Sebastian de Cassel, huge thanks. Anna, did you enjoy your first ever Author of the Week feature?
Very much, I did. And I still have so many questions left, so I can't wait to get the chance to ask you again everything that I have in mind.
It's all going to happen. For the moment, Sebastian de Cassel, keep on keeping on and keep on writing.
Thanks so much.
So back in the day, people used to say 10,000 hours. That's what you need, 10,000 hours to really become a master of a mistress of something. What about, of course, consuming aspects? What about 1,000 as a number? What about reading 1,000 books? What could that lead to? Well, according to our next special guest, that could conceivably lead you into the kind of mindset that means you can become a best-selling international author, the likes of which, you know, probably might create a Harry Potter or something. Of course, we're delighted to welcome the person who's actually come up with this scenario, a Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Amazon, and Audible best-selling author. He's already sold nearly 4 million books, over 25 Kindle bestsellers. He's the tremendously talented Richard Haywood. How are you, Richard?
Hello, thank you. That's very nice to meet you. That was a very lovely welcome. It's very nice. Thank you.
Thank you. We lost a little bit of you there, but I think it was possibly lost in translation. Never mind. It was
okay.
Slight challenge with the Zoom zone. That's better. I think we're okay. So, I mean, clearly you are a success with respect to that. I mean, just in case people haven't heard of R.R. Haywood, we're talking about the Extracted series, the Undead series, the Code trilogy, the Delia trilogy, Town Called Discovery. But what is it about this notion that if you read 1,000 books, that could effectively be much more use to you than actually going on one of the ever-growing number of creative writing courses that are springing up in universities across the land?
Well, it kind of came around, a kind of long journey, as it were, because I've been traditionally published and I've self-published. I've become very successful in self-publishing, thankfully. But I never got past high school education. I only ever went to high school education. Then after high school, I joined the police, and my English was good enough for the police. And then later when I came into writing, I noticed my grammar was really quite bad. You know, I was getting picked up a lot, especially with my early books when I was self-publishing. It fazed me, so I just kept going. And then later I was traditionally published through traditional publishers, and that helped me grow my platform. But then I went back to self-publishing because I really enjoyed the freedom of it. And as that grew, particularly with my latest book, Fiction Land, which just came out last week, which is obviously really quite a meta experience because it talks about there's this kind of John Wick style character that's in a very awful kind of cliched, trope-dripping story. That's kind of my way of parodying all the action adventures, revenge thrillers that we see all the time. He gets killed during a story and he wakes up in a city that is populated by lots of fictional characters, lots of Harry Potters, James Bonds, Sherlock Holmes, that kind of thing. And then through his journey, we get to experience all the different genres of writing, science fiction, fantasy, noir, crime, everything across the board. So it was a real good exploration. And that's done really well, that book. But that's what prompted a lot of people to reach out, obviously, because it's a book about fiction and it is a fiction book. That prompted a lot of people to then start discussing, well, best way to do it. Now, I kind of said, well, I've never done any kind of creative writing courses. I've never done anything like that. I've just kind of applied myself to the task at hand and self-taught. And then I started thinking about the people I know that have done creative writing courses. Now, first of all, I'm sure there are people that have done creative writing courses, whether that be a university degree in any shape or form, and that have gone on to become very successful and written amazing books. I personally don't know any, and I don't know anyone that has done a creative writing course of any style and has then gone on to produce a best-selling book or a book that has sold commercially well. And having spoken to them, I get the impression that they become over concerned about the technicalities of the writing, whether it's a three-act structure, a five-act structure, every character's got to have an arc, whether somebody's an alpha character, a beta character, and so on. So they become so worried about the technicalities that each scene has to be the right length, and the narrative has to be the correct way. And they become so concerned about the technical aspect, they forget about the creative magic that happens when you write a book. You know, that experience of just being yourself and you using your own voice. And the other thing I noticed as well, being mainstream published, was there is a very big emphasis on London and New York centric editing styles. So particularly, I live on the Isle of Wight, but I was born in Birmingham. So I've been around people with strong accents all my life. And I think that's a beautiful thing, people that speak with local accents. But I've noticed that particularly in fiction lately, that's been stripped out. And I've had incidents with mainstream editors when I've been writing dialogue that I want to be phonetic in the style of, say, somebody from Liverpool or Manchester or Scotland or anywhere in the world. And the editors are correcting that and putting it back into what should be perfect grammar English. And I'm having these constant conversations going, well, that's not how people speak. People don't speak in perfect English all the time. So this is a very long story, but basically it comes out that when I'm writing fiction land and I'm journeying through all these different genres and people are saying to me, how did you teach yourself to write? Well, I did it by reading. You know, I must have read at least 1,000 books, probably more. And I was just absorbed in lots of different genres, horror, science fiction, fantasy, crime, everything I could get my hands on. And I think that's what did it for me. And when I look back on it, especially with fiction land, because in each particular scene in fiction land, the main character is going into different genres. So I wanted to be able to capture the way that genre writes. Now, for instance, fantasy, science fiction, noir, crime, they have different styles to them. And by reading so many books in so many different genres and absorbing that, that's what helped me achieve the different narrative styles in fiction land. So, yeah, I appreciate that it on the face of it, it sounds quite controversial. Don't do a creative writing course, just read books. But I think there's a lot of authors that's worked for and it's done well for, you know. So I think that's really what it is.
You mentioned a number of key areas there. And again, there probably isn't ever going to be a thing as one size fits all. From your own perspective, a frequent line is used, we write about what we know. So you mentioned John Wick, and I have to say, is John Wick in any way based or John Wick-like a sort of aspect? I mean, not John Wick, but in terms of that, was that based on your experiences as a police officer? There areas that come from that you kind of almost subconsciously see emerging in your writing?
Yeah, absolutely, definitely. I mean, I was a police officer, and obviously in the UK, thankfully, we don't have any kind of John Wick style character.
Well, not that we know of. I mean, who knows what goes on there these days?
I'm sure there are people out there that want to be like John Wick. But, you know, the police. Yeah, no, absolutely. And sometimes it's not in the way that people think it is. It's not always in terms of the big events that we see, because they're actually in a police officer's career. I mean, I did 22 years. Big events are quite few and far between, you know, things like train crashes, you know, planes coming down, big incidents, big major incidents. They're exciting, and you get a lot of experience and you can draw a lot from them, but they don't happen every day. It was the everyday policing that fascinated me with human behavior. How people react in different situations, going into people's. I was a uniform police officer through the rest of my career. I worked squads, disrupting drug supply, violence, that kind of thing. So I was always at the sharp and pointy end. So it was always human behavior that.
Or the brown end of a stick, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely, definitely. And even by the end of it, you know, I've come out of it thinking I absolutely loved my career and I'd do it again in a heartbeat. But without a shadow of a doubt, yes. Yes, in every book I write, I'm drawing from experiences.
And in terms of obviously reading in your own consumptions, I mean, the fancy academic word, of course, for your latest novel is it's a classic example of intertextuality, because you're making links between all manner of already existing texts in the same way as Philip Jose Farmer did in his Riverworld series with To Your Scattered Bodies Go, in the same way as Alan Moore does with League of Gentlemen, or League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, I should say.
Yes.
Was that something which may have influenced your kind of notion of, well, let's draw this intertextual aspects together and actually start bringing in different levels?
Well, I struggle with this with every book I write, because I kind of straddle multi-genres. Every book I write is... Because I love the aspect of that, the kind of the old British stiff upper lip, dark humour in a crisis. That's in our country. That's pretty much all we've ever had to cope through, hasn't it? You know, during the Second
World War. Especially with the likes of Rishi Sunak, Liz Truss, Boris Johnson. I could go on, basically.
But absolutely. In dire times, there's this kind of resilient humour that comes through the British way of life.
Or gallows humour.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. I'm coming from a policing background. Paramedics are the same, fire officers are the same, you know, soldiers are the same. I get a lot of feedback from all quarters, from all emergency services. That kind of dark humour that carries you through. And it would be such a shame to see that eroded. So that carries through my books. There's always strong humour evident in every story. And then I take an ordinary person, an absolutely completely ordinary person, I'll put them in extraordinary settings. Time travel or space or post-apocalyptic setting, or in this case, something where fiction land, where somebody wakes up and realizes they were just a character in a book and then they've got to face their own.
Happens to me on a daily basis.
We all feel that way, don't we? We all feel that way. And so, yeah, it kind of straddles genres. And I've had conversations with publishers and agents and editors all my career where they've said the problem we're having is these books that you're presenting, they're selling brilliantly. You know, you're shifting millions of copies and gaining great reviews, but we're putting you through to, say, Waterstones or Smith, for instance, and they just don't know where to put you. They don't know whether to put you in a crime thriller. Are you a comedy writer? Is it a drama? And I'm going, well, it's all of those things. So they're saying, just go back and just write one genre. And I'm going, well, I don't want to. So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is. It is multifaceted.
And in terms of that, of course, the book industry has changed so remarkably thanks to the web, thanks to the online ebook scenario. Question we often put to authors, do you still like to believe that your reader, the ideal Richard Haywood reader, will pick it up as a book and actually read it physically? Or is it a case of, as long as they're reading it, I don't care whether it's online, on their laptop, on their phone, whichever system they actually use?
I like the accessibility of it. So however somebody absorbs the story is I'm happy with that. If they want to, most of my sales are ebook sales. So I, you know, Kindle, and the digital space, that's what we call it, isn't it? I've come to sell mostly in the digital space and I'm happy with that. I love that. And I also love the fact that I've got access to the software system. So if there's a mistake, if there's an error, if there's something about it that isn't working, I can change it quite quickly and re-upload. So it's very reactive and it's good like that. But yes, I'm still in love with paperbacks. If I come across a book that I love, I'll read the Kindle version, then I'll order the paperback because I still want that possession, you know. But then again, half of my sales are through audio as well.
Again, the whole other area. I'm also reminded of the classic George Bernard Shaw quote, which I think you probably find resonates quite solidly with yourself, given what we've been talking about. Those who can do, those who can't teach. I'd always add to that, those who can do neither become administrators, but that's by the way.
That's very true. That was very true in the police as well.
Yeah,
that was evident in the police, yes, very much so.
As we actually progress through this 21st century, clearly artificial intelligence is mentioned frequently. ChatGPT is mentioned frequently. I mean, you could arguably say, forget creative writing classes, just learn to write a computer program, and that'll make you sell mega course of books. Is that something which, again, you kind of reluctantly accept in terms of, well, okay, it's here, but ultimately that whole special relationship you have between a writer, and the other sense that comes across is that passion that a writer has for their writing and their personal input into that, as opposed to, well, let's just press a few buttons on the keyboard and bang, there's 10,000 words done.
That's a great question. That's I love that subject. I put a book out in, I released a book in February called Delio, which is about the world's first sentient, fully self-aware AI. It was created by the US military and housed in a bunker. It finds a way to get out, takes over the world, makes everybody freeze because it realizes that human beings are dangerous and they can't be in control of the world. So I really explored AI and I really went into where we are now in terms of AI, especially with the onset of ChatGPT and art platforms like Midjourney and DALL-E and all the others, and what AI could do for us. And I'm of the firm belief that I embrace it. I think this system is here. It's never going to go away. It's like the internet. Once we've got it, it's never going to go. And if we can make it work for us, then fantastic. Imagine in 10 years time that, because at the moment, obviously, we all struggle to get a GP's appointment or see a doctor. Imagine in 10 years time when you can just boot up an AI system and you can converse with the AI system and say, I'm feeling this way. And imagine if you can be diagnosed and pointed in the right direction for treatment, or even prescribed the right medication, all through an AI system that's done within minutes. That's going to save lives. It's going to make humanity better. There's going to be huge issues about unemployment and all those kind of things. And yes, Amazon, I know because I work predominantly with Amazon, they've suddenly, there was a huge glut of people trying to put short stories and novellas written by ChatGPT out as novels. Amazon very quickly realized this, and now they've got disclaimers on their software system at the back end when self-published authors like me load up. Is any of your content generated by AI? And that's to do with the actual book itself or any of the art on the cover. So you have to tick those. And it says, if we discover any of your book is generated by AI, we reserve the right to remove it instantly. And I think that's a good thing. But in terms of creating stories, books, novels, I've played around with ChatGPT a lot. I even co-wrote a short story with ChatGPT, with me playing the part of a character and ChatGPT playing the part of an AI character. And it was good fun. But at the moment, I can't see that replacing writers and authors. I'm sure that will come, and it would generate incredible stories and great plots. And it will be very, very hard to discern whether it's been written by a human or an AI. So I don't know what's going to happen there. But I'll tell you one thing, if I may just add one caveat to that. I love visual art. I really do. But when I know, as soon as I know that that particular piece of art has been generated by AI, it diminishes my interest in it. And it's the same with any content that's been created. I can admire it, but the second I'm aware that it's AI generated, I'm thinking, well, there's no soul behind it. There's no love. There's no passion. And that instantly reduces the desire for me.
That could interestingly be another line of another ism. It could be robotism, where
Absolutely.
You're accused of being robotist. And
you
could be a robotist in terms of your views and various other points. And I'm not going to go down that line because I think J.K. Rowling has suffered enough when it comes to obviously her particular viewpoints with respect to trans and other sort of issues. From your own perspective, Richard, we've already talked about the AI and the intelligence from that point of view. What advice would you give the young Richard Haywood, who's just joined the police force, who effectively has started off a career and likes reading, and obviously from a point of view from that perspective, what would you actually give if you could turn back the clock and use one of those time travel tropes to actually sort of go and speak to your younger self?
Wow, what a question. Because we've followed the journey haven't we, to be where we are now. So you kind of think, well, if I went back and said something to my younger self, that would create a deviation, then I wouldn't be the me now. Would I be more successful, less successful? How? And then all of a sudden it's a parallel kind of existence, isn't it? So probably not, no. I probably wouldn't say anything. I'd probably just, yeah, if I was to say to any younger person, particularly joining public services, you know, don't be self-centered and don't be self-absorbed. You're there to serve, so serve well. You know, you're there to help others, and that's a big thing, and it generates a lot of fulfillment. And from that, you can draw a huge amount of experiences. And particularly if you're interested in any kind of creative arts, there's in any public service, there's a wealth of experience you can draw from. And don't be timid. That's the other thing. I think being timid these days isn't a good thing. You know, we need to be a bit more outspoken about issues that are going on in the world.
There does seem to be a certain law of inverse proportionality there between timidity and keyboard warriorship.
I don't mean that. No. Yeah. That doesn't serve anyone at all, does it? No.
But again, I have to ask, do you have your Instagram, TikTok, and X accounts to the fore? Is it a case of no, I steer well away from any Elon Musk material?
I use all of them. Facebook serves me really well. I've built up a good platform on my Facebook page. That's predominantly 99% of my traction is on Facebook. And I love it because I get great interaction with my readers. I can release a book and I can see straight away within a few days what the readership are liking or not liking. So then when I come to write book two, because I'm a series writer, when I come to write book two, I think, well, that character worked well. I'll develop that character or that storyline because I've got that instant feedback. I can run competitions, engage with my readers, and that serves me really well. Twitter, I've used that less and less now. It's just too full of.
You're an ex-Twitter user, perhaps.
Yeah, an ex-ex user. Yeah, it's just too angry on there. It's too polarizing for me. I'm hoping it will settle. And I understand Elon Musk is trying to do with the whole free speech thing, but it's just whoa when you go in. It's yeah. TikTok. Yeah. I've started putting out some creative writing tips on TikTok. Just short 1 minute things, just helping people. So that's building up. But yeah.
And maybe Elon himself actually simply wants a rocket to actually not explode after a few minutes, but that's another issue entirely. Okay, if people wish to access your website, Richard, where would you point them?
Haywood.com, nice and simple.
Haywood.com, fantastic. The book, of course, is called Fiction Land. It's out now. You can access it on all platforms that we've actually mentioned from that point of view. Also, you can still find the post-apocalyptic zombie series, The Undead, which is out from that point of view as well. So that's great stuff. It's brought us neatly around to two final questions, of course, all too soon. But Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today?
I have. This has been the nicest interview I've done so far. It's been really lovely. Thank you so very much. I've really enjoyed these questions.
Well, the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to join us again in the not too distant future? Will you be kind enough to return?
Of course. Yes, I would love to anytime. Definitely.
Richard Haywood, R.R. Haywood, to be precise. Many thanks indeed. And keep on writing.
Thank you very much. It was very nice to meet you. Thank you for having me.